inside out church, and I didn't pick on anybody to lead prayer beforehand. I usually ask. Todd, there you go. Just looking like you wanted to lead a prayer. Todd's going to say a word of prayer for us, if you would, and then we'll start with class. So tonight we're going to be looking at the concept of being prepared for harvest, and a church that wants to be growing has to put the pieces in place to grow and have a response for the different stages of growth and conversion. You can't wait until it happens and then say, oh, maybe we ought to do something about that. You kind of have to pretend like it's already happening. You have to decide we believe God will bless with growth if we prepare accordingly. And probably the best and simplest metaphor for that is the one Jesus often uses of the idea of a field with seed in it and harvest. A farmer can't wait until the crop comes in to decide, maybe I'd act like a farmer, right? He has to go through all the steps before he has fruit yield if he wants to have any fruit yield. That's the only way he can get there. So the concept we're going to look at is prepared for harvest. Quite a lot of our discussion will come from Mark chapter 4. And so if you want, we'll hop around a couple other places, but the primary focus is Mark chapter 4. So Mark chapter 4 has, at the beginning, the parable of the sower in the field and the different kinds of soils. And then it has a parable that we're going to read just now on the growing seed. It's an often overlooked parable because the other one in Mark 4 is so much more interesting and longer and fascinating. So we skip this one, but this one's actually very important to discussion tonight. And then it also has the parable of the mustard seed in it, which reminds us that things that grow get larger than the seed itself. The growth is always more than you might expect. So all that's going on in Mark 4, which is why we'll be there quite a lot. Somebody want to read for us Mark chapter 4, 26 through 29. We'll get the parable of the growing seed. James, thank you.
And he said, the kingdom of God is as if a man should scatter seed on the ground. He sleeps and rises night and day, and the seed sprouts and grows. He knows not how. The earth produces by itself, first the blade, then the ear, then the full grain in the ear. But when the grain is ripe at once, he puts in the sickle because the harvest has come.
Now here's just a thought for you to think about in this chapter. This chapter already has the parable of the sower. It's much longer, and it even has then a second part where he comes back and says, here's what that meant. So why do we get included this other parable? That seems like, if you're not careful, it just sounds like a shortened version of the parable of the sower. Apparently, this parable makes a point that the longer one did not, so that you can read that one and then read this one and still get something out of it. It's not just a repetition. Jesus told a shorter version of the parable one time, so Mark included it. No, I think this is a parable with its own set of points. The parable of the sower mostly emphasizes the soils and their content. The point of this parable seems to be about the mystery of the growth process. That whether you're an ancient farmer or a modern farmer, there is still something very mysterious about you just put the seed in the ground and something happens, right? You can put all the gravel you want in the ground and nothing happens, but you put the seed in the ground and something happens. And so the farmer, I mean, it's a reliable mystery. It's not mystery in the sense of I have no idea if it's going to happen or not. It's reliable. You can build your whole life around it. Farmers do every year. But at the same time, they confess that there's something about it they don't quite understand. They go to bed at night, and they come out, and there's something green. Okay, so that seems to be the point of the parable, and it is a process. They don't put the seed in the ground, and then the next day they go out and harvest. There's a process that every farmer understands, that it's a long process between a stretch of land full of rocks and trees and brush to a productive field. And there are bits of it that aren't up to the farmer, but it is a process. So point number one for tonight that I want to emphasize heavily, conversion is a process, not an event. Okay? I'm going to say it again. I may say it 15 more times. Conversion is a process, not an event. Now, there are moments in the conversion process that are more noticeable than others, where something happens and you say, aha, there it is, right? And so we have a tendency to say, that's what happened. That's the thing. That's conversion. Okay? But that's not how it works, is it? Just like the farmer goes outside and he sees a field, and he'll see that first little shoot of green come out of the ground. Is that all there is to farming? Well, I mean, that's a moment where you say, oh, hey, something's happening, hooray. But that's not what farming is. Farming is a whole process. It's not just that one day or even the day of harvest. It's a process. And the same is true in this parable, that conversion is a process, and it is a lengthy one. I suspect churches have gotten very good at looking at that moment and saying, how do we do that? But we have not been very good at the process of conversion. So, for example, this comes out of the book we're using for this class. We know how to answer the question, what must I do to be saved? We are less prepared to answer, what is truth? So if somebody walks up to you and says, well, I believe all that, what do I do now? I think most of the crowd that shows up on a Wednesday night in a church building could give them some kind of response. For better or worse, you could kind of work your way through it. Here's what you should do now. But how often do you run into a person who is at that exact moment, who just looks up and says, I'm ready, tell me what to do? It's actually very rare to just run into a person in that state. In fact, I'll go a step further. Unless the other things have happened first, you will essentially never meet that person. And what you'll do is instead you'll preach these pessimistic sermons about people just don't want truth anymore and people just don't respond to the gospel anymore. But what has happened is we forgot that there's the process that we have to go through. And we don't know why people aren't here. It's like a farmer saying, my field just doesn't produce anything anymore, but he stopped working it. See the problem? It's not like nature stopped working. It's he didn't go through the steps he needed to do to participate in what God does in a farm. So preparing for the harvest means acting fittingly at every stage of the process. What does a farmer do? Isn't that a very varied skill? One day on a farm looks a lot different than the next day on the farm. One day you're doing this to the ground, the next day you're doing that, and the day after, especially now, I mean, it's always been that way, but some of the more technical things involved in modern farming, there's just a lot that goes into it, and there always has been in its own way. That what you do at different times of year is different than other times of year. If you go plow the field when it's time for harvest, you're going to find yourself very disappointed because you plowed under your fruit, your grain. But if you go out and try to harvest when you need to plow, you're also going to be very disappointed. So there's a proper and fitting response to every step of the process. And that's what an evangelistic church has to be considering. So that's point number one. We're going to go through that in more detail, but I want to give you the two big points of this lesson first. Number one, and I'll say it again. Everyone say it with me in your head. Conversion is a process, not an event. Number two is that conversion is not entirely up to you. In fact, we might dare say conversion is not at all up to you in this sense, that God is ultimately responsible. humans participate, but God is ultimately responsible. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 is another memorable passage about growing and planting. Somebody wants to read for us 1 Corinthians 3, 6 through 9. Denny, thank you. So, did Paul and Apollos do anything? You can almost give two answers to that and be right either way, right? If you say yes, Paul says, I planted and Apollos watered. We did something. But then he comes back in verse 7, so neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, right? So, yeah, we did something, but no, we didn't do anything. Who makes trees grow? Who makes plants grow? We teach this. This is nursery school lesson we teach down in the little kids' classroom. Who makes trees, kids? Only God makes trees. Right? Only God makes things grow. Well, it turns out spiritual conversion and the shaping of a mature Christian disciple life is exactly the same. Who does that, kids? God makes things grow. Okay. No amount of human skill, practice, or ingenuity makes things grow. This is always my hesitation. If it sounds like I'm hesitant when we do evangelism classes, this is why. I never want to leave people with the assumption or the persuasion that if you train yourselves really well, if you get yourself really prepared, then you can be a good evangelist and you'll convert people and that's the way it works, as if it were in a process that was up to you. There are things that you do. There are things that a farmer does, and some farmers are better than others, and you can learn some skills, and that's important. But the Christian cannot afford to ever forget that God does the growing, not you. And there is no amount of skill or practice or expertise or programs or ingenuity or any of that that replaces that basic fact. If you start there, then we can talk about evangelism, and we can talk about how to do better at sharing our beliefs and convictions with others. But it has to begin there, or we will never get it right. In fact, I'll go so far as to say this. I don't believe God will allow something to grow that we try to grow without him. I don't think he'll allow it. So I think there is a necessity to begin with that understanding. No amount of human skill, practice, or ingenuity makes things grow. The church is tasked with responding to the growth that God is creating. God is doing something, and like farmers, we get to participate. Farmers don't make wheat. God makes wheat. Okay? Does that point seem fair from those two texts we've read that we need to remember? Now, with that said, what does the process of growth look like, and what is our part in it? Now, if we take that as our baseline understanding, we can kind of visualize the journey for a moment and identify what we do along the way. What would be, let's see if we can guess, what would be the first thing that has to happen if you want to have a successful farm, you want to harvest, and you buy a property somewhere out in the middle of who knows where, you buy a property that's not a farm, you're not buying a farm, you're buying a property. Okay, what has to happen first? Sorry? Okay. You start out with uncultivated land. Okay? It's not a farm. It's not anything. It's just doing whatever it does. Wild and woolly, and you could stare at it for 1,000 years and it never would become a farm. That's not how it works. It's just out there doing its own thing. And so once you get this uncultivated field, you have to prepare it. And that's every country boy's favorite job, which is clearing a field. Right? Nobody enjoys that. Dad had 10 of the most miserable acres on the face of God's earth that we often commented. We We grew thorn bushes at our farm. That was all we ever grew. I don't think we ever had anything you could call food, but we grew a lot of good thorn bushes, and we spent quite a lot of our time trying to clear that poorly. The next thing you do is you clear that field, because if what is in it remains in it, then the farm can never grow. Okay, so you clear the field. Is it ready now? Well, somebody said something about soil. We got to do something to the soil. Now, if we're going to be real smart farmers, we're going to analyze it and all that. But at the very least, we've got to do something to the soil. Sorry?
Fertilize it.
Till it. Break it up. Okay. We're going to need to plow the earth. Okay? We've got to take the earth that has been used to just being stomped on and turn it into earth that's ready to grow something. Okay? Then, finally, we get to the part that's exciting. We get to put some seed in the ground, right? We get to go do that. Okay, we're going to go put something in the ground. You can till it all you want. It doesn't start growing anything but weeds until you put something else out there. We're going to sow a seed. And then, like the parable we just read in Mark 4, you sow your seed and then you go to bed. I mean, there's a lot of other things you can do, but ultimately, to boil it down, you go to bed one night and you wake up in the morning and there's this little green thing, right? And it happens in its own good time, or it doesn't, but God does that part and you have very little to do with it. But there is a moment of visible growth. When you see the first visible growth, is it ready for harvest? If you go out there and start cutting it, no, you ruin everything. In fact, when you see the visible growth is when it's at its most delicate. This is when it could all come to nothing. And so the final step then, after growth, will be harvest. So let's go piece at a time and think of a spiritual life as a process of conversion, following the description of in this metaphor that Jesus uses so frequently. Starting out with uncultivated land. Turn to Luke 23. Verses 33 through 36. And let's think for just a second about uncultivated land. Uncultivated land, when you look at it, the old farmer expression is, there's more rocks than dirt out there. Now, I didn't do a lot of farming. I admitted that. We did a lot of bush pulling, but not a lot of farming. But I did help a guy one time who was convinced he needed to turn his pasture into a baseball field. He was going to have little league practice out there, so he wanted to turn his field into a baseball field, which is a similar process, it turns out, because he wanted grass, not weeds, and he wanted nice dirt that you could slide into, not rocks that would rip your shins open. And so we spent quite a lot of time picking up rocks, right? Usually after you tripped over one, you'd say, oh, there was one, or you slid into second base and you say, yeah, there was one. You need to get that one, coach, and we'd go dig that one up. But when you first see that field, he saw a baseball field. It was filled with dreams for him. He saw a baseball field. The rest of us saw a lot of work. Okay, there was more rocks than dirt out there. It just looked like a mess. The farmer could look at it, if he's a little pessimistic, and say, nothing's ever going to grow there. Not possible. That's just a mess, right? I suspect Jesus saw something very similar to that in his view from the cross. Somebody read Luke 23, 33 through 36. Todd.
And when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and one on the left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And they divided his garments and cast lots, and the people stood looking, but even the ruler was with them, sneered, saying,
is there anything Jesus could have said at that moment that just in a statement he could have said and changed the hearts of the people there and they all repent and they all submit to him as Lord? Is there anything he could have said at that particular moment or done to change everybody's mind? He's the master teacher. I assume if it could have been done, he would have said, oh, by the way, you haven't noticed this yet. Did you know this? And they would all said, oh, we didn't know that. Take him down. That's not the way it worked. It was an angry mob. more rocks than dirt. Looking at that group, could you have imagined that those people would ever repent? Bloodthirsty? Can you imagine that they would ever decide the person on the cross was the Lord of the universe? That takes some imagination. So Jesus doesn't try to preach a sermon and convert them. What he does is he offers up a prayer that they could someday be forgiven. Peter preaches a sermon later. That's in Acts chapter 2. But today, all Jesus does is he looks at that crowd, who on that day were murderers, and said a prayer of hopeful optimism that they could be forgiven for a terrible sin. The great old preacher Spurgeon said, "Until the gate of hell is shut upon a man, we must not cease to pray for him. And if we see him hugging the very doorpost of damnation, we must go to the mercy seat and beseech the arm of grace to pluck him from his dangerous position." He goes on to say in that little sermon, while there's life, there's hope. Until they're on the other side of that gate, we, at the very least, can pray for them. Are there people we encounter that we say, boy, there's no hope for that guy? People we encounter, I don't know how you stay optimistic, Bill, in prison ministry, because I assume you encounter a lot of people that would be easy to look at and say, well, not that one. I assume they didn't get there by being model citizens. Is that right?
It's usually the ones I least expect. The ones who start in class and are very hesitant to do anything other than come in and make their grades and get a certificate. Gradually start changing. I mean, admit, I came in to get a certificate. Now I realize that I need a lesson.
Turns out we're not very good at judge of soil after all, right? That we're not very good at it. We look at it and say, well, not that one. And so what Tim Archer, the author of the book we're using, suggests that at this phase in the process, your first job is to pray that it could be so. And sometimes that's the best you can do. Sometimes you can do more than that, but sometimes that's a starting place, is to start praying for those you find least likely be the soil of the kingdom, and to find precisely that they are. Jim?
Well, to go back to your statement about the worst 10 acres that the place of the earth is the 10 acres your dad owned and decided to eat that farm. And we, as humans, look at people and say, oh, there's too many rocks in that field.
Yeah.
Well, are we looking at it, there's too many rocks in that field, or there's just too much work there?
Yeah. Excuses make you feel smart when you're actually being lazy is quite often. Excuses make you feel smart when you're actually being lazy is quite often the case, right? It's the things we say to ourselves to make ourselves feel better about not doing the work. So instead, Jesus looks at them and he prays for them. Okay, and then dies for them and commands his disciples to go do work in that very field, right? So that's task number one, is to look at those who are far from God, and we'll start by prayer. So maybe things change, the field gets cleared. What do we do now? In John, the 4th chapter, somebody wants to read a little bit for us here. This will be John 4, 35 through 38. This is the end of the story of the Samaritan woman at the well, and Jesus has spoken to her, and they've had this lengthy conversation, and here's what's going to happen next. John chapter 4, 35 through 38. Somebody wants to read that for us. Bobby, thank you.
Do you not say there are yet 4 months, then comes the harvest? Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for harvest. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life, so that sower and reaper may
We always preach this one wrong. We always emphasize the point that we need laborers to go out for the harvest. And I'm not sure that's Jesus' point. Jesus' point is, yes, you get to go harvest because somebody else has already done all the work. Somebody else cleared the field, and so today, the field is white for harvest. Just go gather it up. There were people walking around asking about Jesus. Hey, that's a good day. You run into a crowd that's saying, who is this Jesus of Nazareth? That's a preacher's dream, right? But that's not how it usually works. So Jesus says, yeah, today we need laborers. But you're the one reaping. Somebody else did the work. Who did the work? And you back up. Somebody read for us, same opening, verses 28 through 30. Or Bob, if you're still there, go ahead and read that, 28 through 30.
So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. And this be the Christ. They went out of the town and were coming to him.
What does this woman know? Almost nothing. I mean, when you think about it, she's not even saying, he is the Christ. She's saying, could be. She knows, I met this man and he was extraordinary. And she just walks around telling people about it. Okay? She actually does the work just mostly because she's interested. I think if you'd asked her, you know, are you trying to spread the gospel and grow the church? She just said the who and the what. She was just talking to people because something interesting had happened and she thought people ought to know about it. She cleared the field. So when the apostles get there, Jesus says, look, there's a whole field of people that just want to hear about Jesus. Go talk to them. Right? But somebody else had cleared the field. The kindness of Jesus had led to a woman publicizing him. Kind words and actions helped clear the field. He was kind to a woman. The woman went and told some people about it. And then you end up with a crowd of people who are interested in hearing more. Again, we're waiting for the end of the story. Where's that crowd of people who want to know about Jesus? Point me at them. But what happened first was kindness, a personal interaction with Jesus and a woman. There are a lot of situations where the field gets cleared and you get opportunities like that. People in crisis, financial crisis, marital crisis. This woman had a series of marital crises, right? Jesus mentions it to her, right? You've got some problems. Spiritual, emotional crisis. They are made ready by God for words of kindness. Those moments are moments of kindness that you can go and it clears the field. Yesterday, you could have told them all the same things and they wouldn't have been listening. If the apostles had come to that town one day earlier, there would not be a crowd interested in what they had to say. Today, there was. Because someone had been kind to a woman who was getting water out of a well. And it sparked something greater. Somebody had their hand up. Bobby, go ahead. Yeah.
And so we studied for several months. And the interesting part there, like you say, once that field's cleared, his statement that he made most often in those Bible studies was, wow.
Yeah.
Because he had no prejudged ideas.
Yeah.
He strictly was just looking at what there was. It's really interesting how that worked through.
Yep. So if a person is just beginning to show some interest, it's a process, not a moment. Don't jump to the end. Be kind, offer opportunities, show love in their life with the words and the actions that you speak, and help clear the rocks out of that field until opportunities begin to arise. We've got to do something to the soil. Luke chapter 3. Somebody wants to read for us Luke chapter 3, 10 through 15. Todd again, thank you.
So the people asked him, saying, what shall we do then? He answered and said to them, he who has two tunics, let him give to him who has none, and he who has food, let him do not intimidate anyone or accuse falsely and be content with your wages. Now, as the people were in expectation.
That's plenty right there. Yeah, that'll do. What here in the textbook that I'm working out of by Archer, he and I are going to go a little different directions in explaining what happens at this step, which I'm allowed to do because I'm teaching. What I see is that at this state, as Nora said, something has to happen to that soil. Okay, there comes a moment when a person has gotten to know you a little bit and they know there's not something not quite right about their life. They are not yet ready for you to talk to them about the gospel or the lofty doctrine of the church and things that they might want to know at some point. There is a moment where you get to say something that is helpful and clear and direct. And you get to say it because you have credibility. For whatever reason, John had become such a genuine figure that people found him believable. We could have a whole sermon about what was believable about John. But John lived such a life that people found him credible. And they actually asked him questions. What do we do? What do they know right now? Nothing. The verse that I didn't have read, they're not sure, is Christ coming? Is John the Christ? Is something about to happen? They have no idea. All they know is John is credible. He's worth listening to. And there's something not right with me. And so they ask, what do we do? And John gives different kinds of answers. Sometimes he gives kind of general, basic moral truths. We need to share more. Give your stuff away. That's first grade stuff, right? Share, kids. Sometimes it's simple. But what is he saying? You're too selfish and you're too greedy. We've got to change our behavior. Sometimes with people that are a little more one-on-one, he can give very direct statements because he has credibility. Let me tell you something. If you walk up to the tax collectors and say, hi, my name is Ben Williams, you're collecting too much taxes and you're crooks. That is the end of that conversation, right? They're ready to fight now because you're accusing them of something. John has built up credibility. They asked him, what do we do? And he said, well, stop being crooks. The soldiers, some of them had been guilty of extortion. And he said, stop doing that. And he can say that to them when nobody else could get away with it because he had some credibility and some patience with these people. And so what another thing we have to do is to build credibility, have some patience, and wait for that moment when somebody says, I just don't know what to do next. And with love and kindness, you say, the reason this is happening and your life is a mess is because there's something very wrong here. Sometimes it's just that generic. It's not a big doctrine. Well, it's because of sin. Now, you see, sin is the biblical doctrine that teaches. No. You don't start with something like that. You say, because something's wrong. That's why something's wrong. Something's wrong because you're doing something wrong. Something has to change. You can't keep doing what you're doing and expect something to be different. Would you consider a change? Would you consider talking about what you're doing in your life? And sometimes it's as simple as that. It's direct. I mean, it really is. Jesus is the kindest of all of our models of behavior. And yet he's the one who most often says, go your way and stop sinning. I mean, he's telling people, you have sin, stop it. He's being very blunt. But he gets away with it. People appreciate him for it because of the kindness and the credibility that he develops with those same people. So your goal in the relationships you have are to look for those opportunities, not to shove on them, but to look for them. And when they come up and they say, Ben, I don't know what to do now, be honest, not rude, be honest. Something needs to change. When a person begins to listen, we begin to speak the values and stories of Christianity. Let me tell you something about this. Now we can finally get back to Mark chapter 4, and we're going to talk about that seed some more. Mark chapter 4, for sake of time, because we're going to run out of it, let me do a little of the reading. Mark chapter 4, verse 3 is the beginning of the story. Listen, behold, a sower went out to sow. That's how the story starts. How do you get a field full of crops? Somebody had to go out there and put seed in the ground. And remember, ancient farming, is distribution farming, right? We're not putting the individual seed. We're kind of flinging, right? And to me, that's a great metaphor for how we spread the gospel. Sometimes we're kind of flinging it. Sometimes I'm very particular about how it's done, and sometimes, I don't know, get it out there. Let's see what happens. There's room for both. Verses 10 through 14 explain, "And when he was alone, those around him with the 12 asked him about the parables, and he said to them, 'To you has been given the secret of the kingdom of God, but for those outside everything is in parables, so that they may indeed see and not perceive, and may indeed hear but not understand, lest they should turn and be forgiven.' And he said to them, 'Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all the parables? The sower sows the word.'" So he says, my parables are tools of teaching, and not everyone's going to get it. But what's being sown is the word. I believe Jesus himself is the seed the world needs, and the word is that capsule that takes him to the world. The gospel story takes people Jesus. It's that kernel that has life within. The new believer must begin with Jesus and the story of his kingdom. Someone's given you opportunity, started a conversation. Where do we start? Somehow we get to the story of Jesus. A lot of different ways to get there, and maybe another class we could talk more in detail. But again, I would say it's not a matter of expertise and craft and ingenuity. It's not because you're a great conversationalist. It's because you're having the right conversation. Somehow get to talk about Jesus and his kingdom. Every question should have a response that includes Jesus and the scriptures that tell of him. If you're talking about Jesus, you're at least close to the right answer. Even if you're completely ignorant of the subject under consideration, if you'll talk about Jesus, we're at least that much closer to saying something helpful to these people. You can't go wrong with that. We show them Jesus in the Word. So I think that's important. We are not converting people to a particular ideology except that of Jesus. We're not converting people to a particular set of beliefs except those that pertain to Jesus. We're not trying to get a membership on a roll. We're trying to get a person in Jesus. If you keep that center, it helps to shape the conversation and the way that it needs to go. Hurriedly now. The next stage, you get visible growth. And if you remember the story of the Mark 4, does everything that grows grow well? Actually, most of it doesn't, does it? Okay. When that little plant shoots up a little bud is when it's at its most at risk, right? Kid runs through the field and steps on it, it's crushed. It's at its most tender, a tender shoot. It's when you have to take care of it the most, when it's at its most precious. And so it is, I think we sometimes rush this step. Please remember that what is obvious to you does not necessarily be obvious to anybody else. For you, you tell them about Jesus and you say, all right, there's water. Let's get to a baptistry. Let's get your name in a church directory. And for us, it's obvious. Well, I assume it's obvious for you because you've already done it. If you told me you didn't see the connection, I would be a little surprised because you have done it. But they haven't. And so I appreciate the urgency of your evangelism, but it's important to slow down a bit and let them work through the connection. This is a tender plant, and there are a lot of obstacles. You see that first little bud of growth? There's still a lot of things that can choke it off, whether it's the rocks in the soil or the thorns or whatever else is out there. So the smallest danger can crush them. New converts need mentors to help them navigate through those early moments of faith and obedience. And they need that for a long time to come. Actually, everybody needs a mentor, but new converts definitely need some guidance to kind of help work through that process. So we partner with them to allow for growth. And we walk alongside them, and it takes as long as it takes. And we're patient. Which finally leads to a harvest. A successful harvest leads to multiplication. The goal is for this person to now have a faith that they can share with other people. That's the goal. 2 Timothy 2:2 says, "Things thou hast learned of many witnesses, commit thou also to faithful men who may teach others also." You learn, and we help them to learn with a passion that allows them to pass their faith on to other people. In and it's a process that multiplies. Well, we're out of time for that last bit, but appreciate your attention, and we'll have a little more on that next week.